Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. How long do you suppose it takes to borrow $1.9 trillion? Huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. I do believe this is the 9th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, one of the really interesting developments in the politics of this economy this past year is how comfortable everybody's gotten with deficit spending. Specifically here, Democrats, who, like Republicans, while their own party was in the White House, have decided that they are going to do now and worry about how to pay for it later. Borrow, in other words. With trillions already spent on this pandemic, though, and another $1.9 trillion in relief set to become law in the next day or so, that is a whole lot of borrowing that's got to be done. Government bonds to be sold is how that works. And as it happens, there's going to be an auction for 10-year Treasury notes tomorrow, that all-important benchmark for everything from mortgage rates to auto loans. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, demand for government debt has not been so hot of late.
The government auctions off bonds to finance day-to-day operations. Add to that last year's relief packages and the potential for $1.9 trillion of additional aid, the government needs to plow out of a lot of debt, says Winnie Caesar, head of credit strategy for Wells Fargo.
The sheer amount of obligations that we have to fulfill haven't been this large on a percentage of GDP basis since World War II.
And to make matters worse, investors have not been buying many government bonds lately, says Guy Labaugh, chief fixed income strategist with Janney Montgomery Scott.
Many investors have been selling their holdings of bonds, demanding higher interest rates to own bonds.
The concern is whether investors don't want to buy bonds at the rate the government's offering in tomorrow's auction, says Jim Vogel at FHN Financial.
If the auction doesn't go well and not enough bidders show up at current levels, then rates will have to spike higher in order to attract buyers.
And that could have a domino effect, says Winnie Caesar at Wells Fargo, because the yield on the 10-year bond influences rates throughout the economy. She says companies might have to pay more on their own bonds. Mortgages could get more expensive.
As borrowing costs for the U.S. government increase, borrowing costs for pretty much everyone else in the U.S. economy increases.
She says that's why the Federal Reserve will be watching tomorrow's auction, too, to see if it needs to step in. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
One of the things all that borrowing is going to do, at least in the short to medium term, is give the economy a shot in the arm. And the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development was out with a report this morning that said the Biden plan and the other relief spending so far is going to help the U.S. economy grow almost twice as fast as expected, 6.5%. this year. But as we know, that recovery looks different for different groups, especially in this pandemic, women. More than 2 million women have dropped out of the labor force since the start of 2020, a lot of them to care for children, as we've been reporting. There is an expanded child tax credit in the relief bill and billions of dollars to support child care. But as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports, child care is still the biggest single stumbling block for women who want and often need to get back to work.
Women's participation in the workforce hasn't been this low since 1988, and women of color are disproportionately affected. Melissa Botea is the Vice President of Income, Security, and Childcare at the National Women's Law Center. She calls the administration's plan groundbreaking.
The American Rescue Plan represents a shift to an understanding that it is working people, and especially women and women of color, that are the economy.
But even a monthly child tax credit of up to $300 will not pay for full-time childcare in the United States today. In West Virginia, one of the poorest states in the country, the cost of childcare averages more than twice that, just over $600 a month. Sarah Jane Glynn, a fellow with the Center for American Progress, calls the rescue plan, quote, a down payment towards economic recovery. But she says the problem of unaffordable childcare is central.
This is an infrastructure issue. This is not about, like, let's do a sweet, nice thing for families. We literally cannot continue to grow and expand if we do not have women working, and that is dependent upon having safe, reliable, affordable childcare.
Advocates say another important step towards helping women go back to work would be raising wages, including the minimum wage, a proposal that did not make it into the relief plan. Another crucial support is pay equity. Elise Gold is with the Economic Policy Institute.
There is no paid leave option for the vast majority of workers. And so who's going to take the unpaid leave? Well, the person who's earning less.
For millions of American women, that's them. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, what? Traders worry? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the early signs that the virus was going to change, you know, everything was when South by Southwest was kind of suddenly canceled last year. Well, another trip around the sun later, the annual conference and associated festivals are set to start next week in Austin. And despite Governor Greg Abbott's recent pronouncement that Texas is 100% open, this year's festival is still going to be online only. Speeches by Willie Nelson and Stacey Abrams, live sets from new bands, film screenings, and business networking get-togethers, all of it virtual. So what do you think? Worth the price of South By admission? From Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
In a normal year, the 100-year-old Paramount Theater here on Congress Avenue in downtown Austin would be gearing up to show new films as part of South By Southwest, films that might have included the documentary about Texas troubadour Guy Clark.
I can just get off of this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught.
The film, Without Getting Killed or Caught, is part of the South by Southwest Film Festival, but you'll have to watch it from your couch. All festival films are virtual only. Jim Ritz is the CEO of the Austin Theater Alliance, which runs the Paramount. He says for the second year running, the Paramount's going to miss out on the rent that South by Southwest would normally pay, not to mention the sale of popcorn and Cokes.
Over those 10 days, we would be screening between 60 to 80 films, doing something like 20 to 25 world premieres.
Los Angeles ad agency founder Nick Cleveroff was going to debut a short promotional film at the festival last year, but South By was canceled altogether. He got a free pass to attend in 2021 as a consolation prize. His wife, who is his business partner, bought a pass for about $400. And even though they're not traveling to Austin, they expect in the end they'll get something out of attending South By online.
In a virtual setting, you know, if that entry gets you into some rooms where a natural connection might happen and something authentic happens, I certainly think it's worth it. And at the very least, you get to watch some cool movies and hear some new music.
Farouk Malik is a bit more dubious. He's not interested in spending $400 for a virtual South by Southwest.
What's the point?
He's a fintech entrepreneur and bought a platinum badge in 2019 to get him into everything at South by, including panel discussions about emerging technology. Those badges go for more than $1,700. Like so many South by Southwest attendees, Malik is in it for the serendipity. Some music here, a keynote speech there, meeting new people over cocktails and tacos.
You lose all of that now because, I mean, I can see a name on a Zoom call, but I know nothing about that person other than that they're there. And I don't even know if they're actually there, right? Because, I mean, I've been on Zoom calls and I've turned my camera off and I'm not actually there.
The South By Corporation really has no idea how many people are going to buy passes this year. Jan Baskett is the chief brand officer.
Obviously, we can't create the beauty of the physical spontaneity, but we're using platforms that will allow for mentor sessions and workshops and roundtables, and it will feel like there are a variety of ways to connect with each other.
After the event was canceled last March, South by Southwest laid off about a third of its staff, almost 60 people, and has since hired back some of them. Austin's business community is rooting for South by Southwest to get through the pandemic. It's just so important to the local economy. Cindy Lowe runs Red Velvet, a local event management agency that depends on South by.
We are struggling ourselves. So we have cut our team in half practically. We are working basically week to week and trying to secure as much revenue as possible.
Lowe says at this point, she's just hoping her company can stick around long enough to benefit from South by Southwest 2022, assuming that version is back to normal. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
What's that? You need everything you need to know to start your business and economic day? We got you covered. David Boncaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. Unilever is perhaps the most conglomerate-y of conglomerates, maker of everything from tea and ice cream to laundry detergent to shampoo and toothpaste. Today, the company said it's making some changes to some of its beauty and personal care brands, Dove and Axe and Vaseline among them. They're getting rid of the word normal from their product descriptions. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains why.
When a shampoo or face wash is labeled as being for normal hair or skin, it's sending a subtle message, says Lisa Wade, who teaches sociology and gender studies at Tulane.
We need to kind of look a little bit at how much work words like normal do in our society.
It implicitly sets the standard of what's okay or acceptable or professional. And
in the beauty industry, it's quite often racialized. And we see it around both products for hair and products for skin. It's been very typical to describe our bodies as normal or not.
A company as big as Unilever, with its 400 brands, is powerful enough to shape how consumers see themselves, says marketer Stephen Jumper at the Ghost Note Creative Agency.
For decades, you know, Black and brown consumers across the world going into their local grocery store, convenience store, and seeing products titled normal and don't align with what they look like.
Jumper says Unilever and other big consumer brands making announcements like this are doing it because they have to.
I think, quite honestly, it's because the consumers has changed. Particularly Black and brown consumers, not only in America, but across the world, are now demanding more.
Unilever also says it won't digitally alter someone's skin color or body shape in ads. Greg Portell is lead partner for the global consumer practice at Kearney.
Unilever's action is going to pull in many of the other brands in the segments in which they compete, and actually, quite honestly, beyond just those segments.
Because now everyone is talking about just who and what we mean when we say normal. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Right now, we don't have a lot of robots on our streets.
Yeah, there may be more of them than you think there are, pal. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 30 today, 10%, closed at 31,832. The NASDAQ up 464 points, 3.7%, closed at 13,073. My colleague David Brancaccio this morning called the NASDAQ an emo band. Really just kind of all over the place. S&P 500 gained 54 points, 1.4%, 35,875, 100 million. That's how many subscribers Disney has attracted to Disney Plus since it launched in November of 2019. Back then, the company said it's going to need until at least 2024 to pick up that many subscribers. Nevertheless, and because of capitalism, shares in Disney down 3.6% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today in This is a Global Economy in Strange and Mysterious Ways, postage rates. A couple of years ago, there was a big Trump administration-led brouhaha over international postage and who paid how much to ship. Very long story made short, and believe me, you are going to be glad to have been spared the details on this one. For going on a year now, Chinese shippers who rely on the United States Postal Service for delivery of their goods once those goods get here have been having to pay higher rates. Marketplace's Jennifer Peck spoke to a businessman in Shanghai to find out how he's coping.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the biggest challenge businessman Bai Haitao ever faced was getting paid on time. He used to sell LED screens on the Chinese market.
In China, it's very common for clients to delay payments. One client took 10 years to pay off an invoice. It was unbearable.
So unbearable that he quit the LED industry and switched to e-commerce in 2017. He mainly sells to the US and Europe through an American app called Wish, a cheap online sales platform. COVID may have cost him business, but at his warehouse in Shanghai, all his employees are back to work. The shelves are fully stocked. He says his top sellers are robot vacuums, cell phone holders, and earrings. But over the past year, Bai Haitao says he came close to shutting down so many times. First, China went into a lockdown, and he still had overseas orders to fulfill.
Shenzhen and Yiwu cities stopped their manufacturing. So we went from factory to factory, begging each one to send us whatever products they had in stock.
Chinese manufacturers finally went back to work last spring, just as the rest of the world went into lockdown. Bai Haitao survived by selling pandemic-related stuff, thermometers, plastic gloves, and sanitizers. Something else saved him too, U.S. stimulus checks.
When the U.S. government handed out money, our orders were really good. Sales in May tripled compared to the year before.
His lucky streak didn't last. In July 2020, shipping fees for sellers like Bai Haitao went way up. See, when products are sent from his Shanghai warehouse, he uses the postal system. Mailing a necklace to the U.S., for example, would cost Bai Haitao just a few pennies. That's cheaper than sending a letter from L.A. to New York. And that's down to an international cost-sharing agreement. Under the deal, the U.S. pitches the bulk of the delivery costs, while developing countries like China pay less. And this is done through the Universal Postal Union. Again, Bai Haitao.
The Universal Postal Union was established more than 100 years ago. It was meant for letter delivery between countries.
But e-commerce sellers like him saw a loophole. They sold only small and lightweight items sent through the postal system.
For small parcels, during peak times, I sent more than 10,000 a day to the U.S. Per year, that's millions of packages from my company alone.
It's not fair, says the U.S. government. And the previous administration under Donald Trump threatened to leave the international agreement unless America pays less, and it got its way. Local news reports say under the new changes, China will pay a lot more subsidies to have its parcels delivered abroad, a 27% increase in 2020. That extra cost, though, gets passed on to American consumers. Bai Haitao has seen his sales drop by half.
I understand why there is frustration in the U.S. Chinese sellers took advantage of the U.S. postal system. We admit that. But ask yourself, why are Americans able to pay so little for Chinese products? Isn't it also true that Americans take advantage of our cheap labor?
As for Bai Haitao, he's still keen to sell to Americans, and he finds they pay on time. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
We don't know, even more than we usually don't know, what this economy is going to look like in, say, 6 months. More people are getting their shots. More schools are opening. Offices, at some point, probably too. That's all top of mind for a whole lot of us, but especially so for retailers who are ordering their fall collections right now and who are having to guess, are people going to be inside in sweatpants or back out wearing dresses, maybe a decent pair of khakis and all of that? After a year in this pandemic economy, we have come to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Kat Wilcox, and I co-own a small boutique called Valoria in Seattle. The shop has been closed for almost a year now. My business partner and I switch off going in to ship orders and do curbside pickup. Such a big part of our business is interacting with people, and I think fashion can get a really bad name as being kind of superficial, but people come to us looking for outfits for their first day of work or outfits for weddings or, you know, outfits for funerals. It can be a very emotional thing. So it really is trying to figure out what that special touch is when you aren't face to face. But it also is not as good as it could be in person. Before the pandemic, Cheek and I would just have pretty quick photo sessions and get everything new up in the web shop that way. So now that Cheek and I aren't there at the same time, I just get the clothing to my house and I've enlisted my boyfriend to take pictures while I art direct him. He still seems okay doing it. Well, and I keep on joking with him. I'm like, well, if you do a good enough job, maybe someday we'll pay you. I just joke that he's our intern.
That was Kat Wilcox. She runs Valoria in Seattle, Washington. Do us a favor, let us know what's going on in your economy, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. A word now about cars. Driverless electric cars. They're not just coming, they're here. Lyft in Las Vegas offers self-driving cars, human operator up front for now, just for safety's sake. And last month, Intel's self-driving venture said it's going to power self-driving shuttles in Europe by 2023. They're kind of like little buses. And as Marketplace's Nova Sappho explains, that look is actually part of a deliberate strategy to solve some of the challenges posed by our automotive future.
Another word for cars that think for themselves at highway speeds is robots. Car designers want to get us used to that idea by making cute robots on wheels that look like overgrown toys, sort of like Tonka trucks or something out of a Lego set.
To some degree, it has to be redefined what robots mean, right?
That's Daniel Hunt. He's the head of design at the startup Neuro, which is working on a vehicle that is essentially two cargo trunks side by side with flip-up doors, designed to haul groceries, not people.
Approachability is really important if you want to build that bridge between technology and humans.
So Hunt designed the Neuro as a mini car. It sort of looks like a shrunken VW bus or a squat Thomas the Tank Engine, too small for a grown adult. Even though no human is driving it, Hunt gave it a sense of the familiar with a heavily tinted windshield.
This sort of idea came from a motorcycle helmet. And technically, we do not need a windshield up front, but we felt like we needed to give the object an area that alluded to something that was more traditional.
Hunt says they tested without the windshield first, and that didn't go over so well. Meanwhile, the Zoox Robotaxi, that's Z-O-O-X, is big enough for people, but there's no driver. It's basically a boxy carriage. Red lights signal the back, white lights up front. They're LED lights, so they just switch colors when the car switches direction. Chris Stoffel, who leads the industrial design team at Zoox, says they had latitude to reimagine what a car is.
Our symmetrical design functionally allows us to have bidirectional capability in a dense urban environment in the city.
It's not just efficient on traffic-clogged streets. The company says it's also efficient in the factory. Cheaper to make because the car is four virtually identical quarter chunks snapped together.
We really kind of have these just big components that come in kind of like Legos and put them together and allows us to have a very, I guess, a streamlined approach to manufacturing and service. And that's exactly what we're looking for.
These concepts seem to appeal to Amazon. It bought Zoox last year. Stoffel says ultimately what matters is what customers think.
And that's really our goal, right? To get people excited about the technology.
A lot of this is about emotion. Paul Snyder teaches automotive design at the Detroit-based College for Creative Studies. He says designers have to combat a sense of the foreign by adding in cues of the familiar.
As of right now, we don't have a lot of robots on our streets, so we're still in a very, very nascent stage of the design, the engineering, and the appearance of these sentient machines or quasi-sentient machines.
Since all of this is so new, designers are playing it fairly safe for now, to get us humans comfortable with cars driving us instead of the other way around. I'm Nupa Safo for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the news item first and then a personal observation. A report by the traffic analytics company INRIX says last year the average American driver spent 26 hours stuck in traffic. Yes, more than a full day, but a far, far cry from the before times average of 99 hours sitting stopped bumper to bumper. That was 2019, by the way. And that is the news. The observation is that my own daily trip from my house to Marketplace World headquarters, because my home internet is lousy, is slowly but surely getting longer, most noticeably in the past week or so, which is good, I guess. My goodness, look at the time we gotta go. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mematolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Wait, what is this? 8 p.m., yeah.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.